kind of confused on this thing. I don't know where to start. Harry Hughes.
Now, Mr. Reed, if you first come over here, let me pin this little deal on you so that we can start the recording order.
July the 27th, 1961, Fairbanks, Alaska, and it's Irving K. Reed. Early life for the Tanaw Yukon Historical Society at Birch Park Recreation Hall.
Just state your name and what's your, little bit about where you were born, a little bit of historical material so that we can wait till I get all started here. And I'll hope that I get something.
Say when.
Okay.
I'm Irving McKinney Reed, born in Seattle, and came to Alaska to the Aleutian Islands in May 1900. And so that makes me going on 62 years in Alaska. Harry Hughes and Andy Wickham asked me to talk about some of the mining in Nome in early days. So, as I was a boy during the strike of the Third Beach in Nome, which is a old beach line, is now buried from 50 to 100 feet underneath the ground, and they had to sink shafts to get at it. And to start that thing going, I think we ought to really go back in the to the first beginnings of Nome, how it started. I knew John Blake, who was one of the original discoverers of Nome. He was discovered in 1900 with some group of prospectors that came out in a small boat and went up the Snake River and just stumbled on it. John Blake was the representative in the AT&T company, and when they found this, they didn't really know what they had. So they asked him, they went to his camp, he was buying furs in the country, and asked him to come over and look at it. And he just recognized it as a very important gold discovery. So he asked them to not to record it or form a stake claims until he could go back to St. Michael's and resign, so he could stake his claim. Well, they got in some kind of a mix-up with the Galliman, and the news got out, and they went and staked the claims. They saved him a claim, all right. They saved him number 8 above on Anvil Creek. That was the only claim in the whole creek that wasn't a real good gold producer. I think he got $8,000 out of it. So that was the start of Nome, and that was in 98. By 1900, of course, the big rush was on, and my father had a sulfur mine on Mount McCushion on Unalaska Island, and that's how I came up there here. And he went back to Philadelphia in 99 and floated a company, and the millionaire that was backing this company came to Dutch Harbor and went up the mountain to look at the sulfur mine. This is before they had the Louisiana sulfur. All the sulfur came from Sicily in the United States. So this sulfur was quite valuable at that time. And this was 98% pure. There's a big deposit up there right on the top of the mountain. Mount McCushion is a volcano. And this millionaire went up there and died. He got heart failure and died at Dutch Harbor. I was there the night he died. And so the whole thing collapsed, and my mother went out, and I and my father went on to Nome. She later on, my sister was up with us. She left my sister with my grandparents and then came on up to Nome to spend the winter. Well, the first I knew about the gold mining was I was about 13, I guess. I remember I went to school. But most of the mining was right on Anvil Creek. In 1900, though, they made an important discovery at Bluff. which is about 90 miles from Nome, and that was probably the richest beach placers ever discovered in the world. And the man that made the discovery told me about it with a very disgusted. He and some others that made the discovery staked the beach. And the law then came out that you couldn't stake a beach. It belonged to the Navy or something like that, and they couldn't claim it. So a bunch of men heard about this discovery from Nome, and they went back and dispossessed the original discoverers. And then they decided they had to divide it up some way. So they laid down fingertip to fingertip on the beach, and each man had $1,500 from that from the beach diggings. I suppose it took him about 2 hours to dig it out. And that was the main discovery. There was another discovery in 1902 on the head of Andrew Creek called Nicola Gulch. A man named Caribou Bill, whatever his name was, I don't know what that's the name everybody knew him by, made a discovery up there and went $100 a pan. And when I was a boy 13, I and Mrs. Noyes, and some other women, my mother, we all went up there. And these women were busily digging in the bank of the gulch there where he had a cut and taking out little nuggets. He was too bashful to object to it. But the thing that made Nome, the Nome was on its way really down, was J.C. Brown made the discovery on Little Creek. Of course, he was digging what he thought was in a creek, but he had to land right square on the third beach. There was a man named Picard in 1900 that drilled the tundra back in Nome, and he was really the one that had an idea there would be a rich streak there. But his company went fluey the next year, and he didn't pursue it. But he found where the deepest part of the bedrock was, and he had predicted there would be a gold strike there. But that didn't have anything to do with J.C. Brown. I knew J.C. Brown very well. And this, in 1903, when he made his discovery, he often told me about it. He sank the shaft down and hit this very rich ground. But there had been so much jumping of mining claims and things, he didn't dare tell anybody about it. So he got hired a friend of his to go down there with a rocker. And they rocked out $50,000, and he took it home and buried it in under the wood box in the kitchen before he told anybody that he'd made the discovery. So they chipped him out of the claim. He had a home. He figured he had enough to live on the rest of his life, which he would have in those days, not today. I took a few notes on the extraordinary richness of the third beach, which ran right along the foot of Anvil Mountain. I was down when I was 16 years old in the Bessie Bench, which is on Holyoke Creek, and about 2.5 or 3 feet off of bedrock, there was a streak of about 2.5-3 inches wide that you had to look real close to see the sand in it. It was almost pure gold. And they just ran the shovel in just below it and took out a pan of dirt, and the guy took it up top side and panned out 19 ounces in that one pan. So that would have been be $20 an ounce, that'd be $180 practically in that one pan. And he didn't even pick it, he just put his shovel in the bank. And I saw when I was there, my father and I went out to see Frank Watsky and his claim. He made a $1 million or so. He could have easily write his check for $1 million. And he had the door of the cabin, he had one of those five-pound lard buckets, you know. He had them full of gold holding the door open. And it was just gold. We didn't think anything of it. We saw in bars, we saw $1 million piled up in the bank window, and nobody ever thought anything about it. They just said, well, they got $1 million piled up in the bank. But they never, nobody ever thought it was anything very extraordinary. And my father had a claim on the third beach. The third beach ran almost straight east and west. Up to a place called Newton Gulch. And right there, my father had a claim. He and two or three of his associates. And that was the only place the beach turned. They just caught a little corner of it. So he missed being a millionaire by one claim, I guess. If he'd been one claim over, he'd been rich. I used to, this was many years later when it was, the cream had been taken out, but I used to have the job. My father was a lawyer for the mining company that owned the claims, and I used to have a job of walking 4 miles in town with $20,000 on my back to the bank to have a week's proceedings. And when I was, I also in 19, summer 1911, I worked in the Pioneer Mining Company's pit. They were hydraulicing there. They had a hydraulic lift, and they were cleaning up every 6 days. They cleaned up $50,000 in that. So it was quite good. And that was a place we were making little ones out of big ones with a big sledgehammer in the pit, so they'd go up the lift. And if the rocks were too big to break up, well, then we had to load them on a stone boat, and the team hauled them out of the pit. And I had my partner was a big Egyptian. He was one of the finest looking men I ever saw in my life, but I never thought Egyptians were that big. He was about 6'2". So that was quite an experience for a young fellow. I can tell some of the other experiences that men have told me in that country. I can tell experience of the man named McIntosh, who was up at Candle. That was a tough country. He had been down setting points, steam points, in the drift. They were drift mining there on Candle Creek on the bench. And all he had on was pants and a jumper and a pair of rubber boots. And when he came up, they hoisted him up, he had to go from the mouth of the shaft to the boiler house where his partner was, and between that few feet he got lost, and the wind picked him up. It was blowing so hard, and about 50 miles an hour, and picked him up. He claimed, he told me this story himself, and picked him up and carried him clear across the creek. And then he wandered all that night with that few clothes on, at 50 below in this terrific wind. And of course, he lost all his, he just had part of one hand left and all part of feet. He could walk, but he couldn't just very barely walk. But he became a school teacher after that. I guess he decided mining wasn't very good. My own experience in mining, I was a boy. I didn't do any. When I got a little older, I sank a few shafts, but we never found anything. But I was too old to get in on the main rush there. Nome at that time produced around 12 at the heyday of the mining, pushed about $12 million a year, and then it tapered off. One time I saw 19 dredges at Nome, but they dredging doesn't keep the country up like the individual mining. The town was going down every year because the dredging companies would bring their crews in and all their supplies, and then they'd come in and be overnight in town, take the boat and go out, and that would be the end of it. And the town didn't get any benefits, so it just went down and down and down. And I don't know, maybe Harry, you can ask some questions that'll bring out.
Well, how about the area that around Nome, how people lived? You told us some pretty good things you had before.
Well, I have a lot of photographs here from early days in Nome. We, in the early days, we didn't have any electricity. We burned coal oil. And we imported our fuel from Vancouver Island, from Nanaimo, and those that could afford it bought Chinese anthracite and burned it. We burned it in a special stove that you only had to fill it once a day. I don't think that was hardly any ashes. I think that was a big main.
That was hauled from the Orient here?
That was hauled from China. China has beds of anthracite coal, and they took it to Nome.
They didn't know we had all this coal in the last community.
Pardon? They didn't really know anything about it. But the railroad, now we have the tremendous beds of coal in northern Seward Peninsula. I was up there, I was associate territorial mining engineer for about 10 years. And I was made a trip up there, an examination of those beds, and the one bed there was over 100 feet thick. Pure coal. It wasn't a high grade coal. It was a high grade lignite, is what it was, but it was coal. And they were building a rail. Then they started the railroad in Nome was intended to go to these coal fields. A little narrow gauge railroad that ran out of Nome. That was put up in 1900. Was made by C.D. Lane. He organized the Wild Goose Mining Company. And they laid laid planks on the tundra and put the ties on top of them, which, when you come to think of it, was the very best way to do it. They did it because they thought they were doing it fast, but it was really the best method because it didn't have any frost heat. And laid ties and put the rails out on narrow gauge railroad and ran it out 4 miles up Anvil Creek to Banner Station. And then they continued it on to Dexter when the deep placers up at the head of Dexter Creek were found. And then a Belgium outfit put up $2 million to continue this across Seward Peninsula to the coal fields up around Candle. And they got as far as the Cusatreen River, but then that was about halfway. I was a boy, I was a rodman on that survey of that railroad. And that was one of the epics, I guess, of the railroad building, because they didn't know how to do it, and they brought up the supplies.
Mr. Reed, can we stop just a minute until I turn that tape over?
Mr. Reed, I'd like to ask you how that gold deposit got there, all that little
bit. Well, I don't know how.
We've had a few minutes stop to change tapes, and there's been a little conversation on here. We'll continue with the program shortly.
I have thought I would take the history of the Seward Peninsula Railroad. Because it's of historical interest, and I don't know anyone that has been in touch with it as much as I have. I saw they had a tremendous lot of trouble getting these supplies out to these men through the tundra. It was took them out by 6-horse teams, and sometimes they didn't get there in time to feed them even, or give them a tents for to sleep in. They got so far ahead of when they were laying the tracks. And I were laying, they built the roadbed by ditching it on the side and throwing the tundra moss up into a sort of a berm. And then,
so like they did down from the last railroad. They did the same thing down here.
Oh,
and
did
it all went away.
Yeah. Well, it stayed pretty well there, but it's gone away by now. But I saw these fellows, some big husky Swedes, would go right out in the rain and lie down in a puddle of water and go to sleep. The water was warmer than the rain, and that was the warmest thing they could get to. And they were so exhausted they just had to sleep, and they'd go and go lie right in the water. You'd think they were dead men, but they were they weren't. I don't think anybody had ever seen that.
To your knowledge, was that one of the first railroads in the interior of Alaska?
That was the first railroad into the interior.
Well, that point would like to be established.
That was started in 1900, but in 1906 they continued it on to the Cousitrine River, 90 miles.
Thank you.
Well, Skagway was before 1900.
That's right, Skagway was. Yeah, that was a year ahead of that, wasn't it, Bob?
98.
Yeah, that's right. But I guess that was that he said in the interior. I didn't.
Yeah, the interior. That was a point of question.
I don't know. Was the old railroad down out of Seward? Maybe that was before then. Do you remember?
That one was built away in the 1900
from Seward.
At Seward. Well, that was way older than the Nome Railroad.
Wasn't that one start in
Catawba?
Yeah.
That was some years later. Wasn't 1906 was in Catawba? I don't remember. Those were on the coast. I wasn't in touch with them.
Mr. Reed, will you repeat the question when they ask it, sort of go on the tape, because we don't record them back here and they won't understand when they go to transcribe it.
Oh.
So if you repeat the question, it goes on the tape and your answer goes with it, and whoever writes it up in later years, we'll know what it was about.
Yeah, well, the question was that the White Pass Railroad was before the Nome Road, and that is true, it was. But I don't know whether the one at Seward was before the Nome Road. I wasn't there. The one at Catawba, I think, was put in about 1906. That was considerably later, the little railroad in Catawba, if I remember right. But that wasn't from my knowledge, but what I read in geological reports.
Thank you.
Cropper Railroad was built in 1907.
Pardon?
Cropper Railroad was built in
1907. 1907, that's right. But there was quite an era of railroad building, but one of the things that kept railroading down in Alaska was that $100 a mile tax that the government put on all railroads. And that, when they were just getting started and before they knew whether they'd pay or not, that when you get out 90 miles of road, that was quite an item. So they didn't last very long. And under those conditions, if that railroad, the money gave out, these Belgians wouldn't put up any more money when they got as far as the Cousit, 90 miles out, about halfway. If they had gone on and gone on to the coal mines, I think they would probably, that railroad would have paid out. But as it was, it became defunct in a few years.
Are they still mining coal in that area today, to your knowledge?
No, they're not. When I was up there, there was one man hanging on to the main mine, this one mine I told you about, that he was hanging on to that. But the other mines, there's no more placer mining to mount anything. They use oil in the dredge that was there, so they quit mining the coal. And they had to bring it in 20 miles by horse teams. So that was quite an expense too. Because the coal was on the Kubruk River. It wasn't at Candle where the gold was. It was 20 miles way over
now,
hill.
A little, Mr. Reed, a little on the communication, time elements and communication, and the way you had to live in those days would be very important in this era.
Well, in 1900, there was no communication by telegraph at all to Nome. I think it was 1902 that they continued the telegraph down to St. Michael's, and from there they their longest radio in the world took it across to Port Safety. I think that is pretty near 100 miles. And from there the telegraph went into to Nome. But letters, it was about 2 months by dog team from outside, or from the end of the railroad.
2 months for the mail to get in.
2 months for the mail to get in.
It takes about 4 hours from Seattle here now.
Yeah. Well, that's quite a difference. I know we are the people out, and that was first class mail, you didn't get magazines. The people used to cut out stories in magazines. There was one story I remember when I was a kid. I got the first installment. I never did find out. I'm very much interested in that story right to this day. But if there's any other questions, I'd like to answer them.
Anyone present would like to ask you a question?
We had people in Nome from all over the world. And they had luxuries brought in by boat. The rich kid was a tremendously rich community. We had everything you could think of. But in 1900, of course, they weren't very much prepared. Coal went up to $150 a ton in 1900, and if you could get it. And in 1900, I know my mother was sick, and my father was paying $2 a piece for fresh eggs. So that even beat Fairbanks prices.
Mr. Reed, Judge Wickersham in his diary mentioned a very fabulous couple of people, a lady who had gotten her start in rather an illicit way down in San Francisco, and she married a millionaire who came up here and operated a gold company in Nome, and Wickersham was quite impressed with her. And I wondered if you knew that lady and the man who Wickersham wrote about. It was a couple months ago in the newsletter.
No, I don't remember the story. You don't remember her name?
No, I don't remember the name.
There's such a hodgepodge of people there, you know, that you wouldn't remember an incident of one mining company.
Mr. Reed, you'll tell about the early day schools.
Well, the first school was in Nome. I went to the first school in Nome. That was on 3rd Avenue. And then they had that fall, and my gosh, there were more kids than they thought, and they soon outgrew that. There was just one single room about this size. And so they evacuated the city hall and turned it into the schoolhouse and gave us the city hall. So we had a much larger school, and we had two school teachers. I even remember their names, Miss Mazay and Miss Young. Miss Mazay was red-haired, and Miss Young was tall and thin.
Do you remember their first name?
No, I don't.
How do you spell Mazay?
I think it was, I haven't any idea. I think it was M-O-U-S-E, I think. No, I don't know, but I didn't pay any attention to her, but But she gave a, both those teachers gave us a very thorough grounding in all the fundamentals that much better, I think, than I would have gotten if we'd gone to a larger public school.
What year was that?
That was in 1900, 1901. Yes, I, well, that was later on. I went with Doolittle and Lord Pebble and those fellows.
Was that private school, prescription school?
Oh, no, they were public school. They weren't governmental, no, they were town schools. They, the townspeople themselves made these schools.
About the churches around 1900, do you remember?
Well, yes, we had a congregation, well, they had the congregation of Presbyterians are combined there. And then they had the Episcopalian and the Catholic churches. My folks were Episcopalian, so I knew about that. And he was there for several years.
Was law enforcement local over there by the town people, or was it?
Yes,
government?
It was by the town people. They had quite a time in 1900. I was in the crowd when I saw the soldiers going up with fixed bayonets up the street to guard the jail, and I didn't know what it was all about, but I was very much interested. But all I can do is to read the USGS reports, and they are kind of garbled. I went out to, in 1904, I went out to military school out in California for a year. And I came back, that was my first year of high school, came back and finished high school. No, they had, by that time, the town had built a very nice wooden school, which was very similar to the one they had in Fairbanks. They had a two-story building, and with a high school and all the grades, and one big school. And they gave us a very thorough high school course there too. I had no trouble getting into the University of California from there. Mrs. Ford was in Nome. Her name wasn't Ford then. It was she had a.
Mrs. Hulda Ford.
Hulda Ford, yeah. She had a boarding house there. Not a boarding house. A rooming house there in 1900. Hotel, Sheldon Hotel. Her name was Mrs. Sheldon at that time. She had married Ford later on.
I'm sorry, I asked too many questions.
No, I'm tickled to death.
In 1913, who was your first legislator under the Organic or the Act which was
Waskey? Not 1913. You mean in Washington, D.C. Waskey went to... went back to, you mean the representative, or delegate?
Right, our first legislator.
Frank Waskey was, I think there was one before Frank Waskey too, but Frank Waskey was a prominent one. He was the one before Wickersham got in, we got our territorial status. He was elected as a delegate under a special dispensation. We were a district then, we weren't a territory, and they gave us representation, and then they made us under, when Wickersham went in 1913, they made us a territory and gave us a legislature. And at that time, we thought we were going, in a year or two, we'd be a state. And I think if we had become a state then, our whole history would have been changed, because we had the population and we had the, I don't know, the elan, if you get me what I mean.
You had the money.
And the money to really do things and develop the country, which we haven't got now. But there were too many forces against us. We had the population too, because Nome was estimated, they never knew how many people were in Nome at any one time, but they estimated from 20 to 40,000 alone.
There wasn't, and I know there are a lot of thing that there was by private companies on it, of natural resources like the fisheries, the copper,
they
had the state government.
That's right, we'd have got more out of it. And at that time, there were so many small mining. It hadn't gone into the big companies, so that there was more wealth distributed. It didn't go back out of the country and to enrich people in Boston and New York, and et cetera.
Mr. Reed, talking about Mrs. Ford, I heard her husband was shot there. Is that so?
I don't know. I never heard that. When she ran the Sheldon Hotel, she was a widow at that time. But my wife, she told her wife a lot of her history at one time, but I don't know if she remembers it. But she never talked very much about Nome. He might have been. I knew the old lady pretty well, but I never got to talk to her about her life there. But she told my wife a lot of stuff, a lot of her life.
Do you know much about Mr. Bill Arthur when he was mayor of Nome?
No.
You don't know anything about him?
No. My father being a lawyer, you see, I was a kid. My father being a lawyer, I knew the lawyers and the judge and and my father was commissioner recorder there. He was appointed by Wickersham, and he was there for several years.
Was law enforcement local over there by the town people, or was it?
Yes, it was by the town people. They had quite a time in 1900. I was in the crowd when I saw the soldiers going up the fixed bayonets up the street to guard the jail, and I didn't know what it was all about, but I was very much interested. But all I can do is to read the USGS reports, and they are kind of garbled. I don't think they got down to the root of the thing.
What was the Eskimo population in there about that time in the immediate Nome vicinity?
Nome? The Eskimos weren't around Nome. They're very conspicuous there now. They've moved in. But the Eskimos were from Cape Nome east along the Big Sand Spit. And in 1900, they had a tremendous measles epidemic in among the Eskimos, and that practically wiped them out. And I walked from Nome when I was 14 years old. I walked from Nome to Salmon with a fellow named Winecoop, an old fellow. He was, my father had employed him, old mining engineer, to look over the country to see what he could find to see anything that was profitable to mine and left anymore. And there was that 30 miles or 20 miles between Cape Nome and Salomon was just practically one solid Eskimo village, but there wasn't a soul in it. They'd all died.
There's much varied culture there.
Well, the big storm of 1913, you see, went over that. Now that's buried, probably those old Inas are there. Ina is the igloo is the snow house. We don't have it in Alaska. The Ina is really the name of their house, their half semi underground house. And they're probably buried under the sand there, and there's probably a lot of this ancient culture preserved there. I'll dig it out someday. But you can go down there now and you can hardly see a trace of that whole village that was there. And it was 20 miles it stretched there. It was solid houses.
Has the sea encroached the area any? Or?
No, I don't believe so. But you see, the big storm was washed right over that spit, the whole length of it. And everything was buried in the sand or washed away. I'm taking up too much time. I'll tell you about In 19, let's see, I was 14 years old. In 1903, some fellows were coming down the, walking down the coast to Nome from Teller. And they stopped at Cape Woolley. There was a little few Eskimo, old Eskimo houses there. There is a little village there now. There wasn't then. And they picked up some tremendously rich gold ore right there at Cape Woolley. And so how I happened to get in on this, my father sent old man Winecoop and me and a couple other men up to look at to see if he couldn't spot this where this gold was, and also to look at the placers on the what we call the Tissue River, but they spell it Tissouk, but we call it Tissue River. And he went over there, and, but he turned all the proposition down. He said the formation was wrong for gold ore. It must have been rafted in by ice into the place. But the on Tissue River there's garnets, oh, tremendous ones, like that. I don't know if they're jewel value or not. Somebody should look into them. Maybe Mr. Baker can someday.
The Indians over there, were they industrious and did they make discoveries and take part in some of our way of life?
The Eskimos?
Mm-hmm.
There were all Eskimos. They were, at that time, they were absolutely uncivilized.
Uncivilized,
yes. They had their own culture, which was, which white men had to adopt partially to get along. And to when they got out in the interior Stewart Peninsula, they even had to adopt their type of houses, more or less. Build them out of sod and things like that. But they were entirely foreign to any American, entirely different than they are now. They are practically Americanized now. But I believe they are the only native people of America who have, due to their environment, have been able to hold onto their own culture and still adopt the American culture alongside of it, which is a very extraordinary thing. And they're very, very smart people. Now, don't let anybody fool you. They are smart people. And there's no lacking in brains among the Eskimos, particularly certain families of them that are very smart.
Do you remember, to your knowledge, is there any hard rock mining over in the Nome area?
They have tried it, but they've never been able to make a stick of it.
I used to hear about some of them tried it.
Yeah, in the Solomon, they had the, and I have been there. They had the Big Hurrah mine, which was the only quartz mine that ever paid in the whole area. And there's possibility still of quartz there, but I don't know. The way gold is now, I don't think of it.
There's other valuable elements in Alaska that's never been prospected. Was there any, to your knowledge, over there?
In Nome?
Evident, yes.
Nome has, Stewart Peninsula is one of the richest areas in the world.
Mineralized
areas, yeah. I know of putting a river mineral there, except diamonds. They have iron, graphite, platinum, copper, antimony, anything you think of.
Was there tin in that area?
Tin is up farther north, but it's in Stewart Peninsula, up on the York Peninsula, what they call it. Extension of Stewart Peninsula beyond Teller. They're still mining tin up there. That's about the...
How about asbestos?
There is asbestos from there. They had lead silver at the O'Malley mine, which is old man Green discovered that way back in the 1887, I think it was discovered. See, Council was, they were mining in Council before they were in Nome. That was discovered before Nome by people that have come up with Green to look at this Amalek mine than to fool around in the country. People are more, seems to me people are more adventurous in those days than they are now.
Mr. Green, could you elaborate on, you know, on this book spoilers, or rather tell something about that that was not in the book?
Well, as a boy, I knew the characters in that. And I knew old Judge Noyce and said hello to him. I knew his wife. I know she I went over and got some things that she, that's one of the hazards of modern life.
Opposition of this action on those claims, or any rumblings at all, or
are
they just
in 1900? Oh, you mean on the? Well, I think the miners were more in sympathy with the people that are trying to take the claims away from these original discoverers.
I wondered why it was allowed to continue to the extent it did before some local action hadn't.
I think that was more or less the reason.
Because of their sympathy being on the other side.
Yeah. The sympathy was of the Americans. You know, the law was that somebody that wasn't a citizen of the United States couldn't stake claims. But the courts ruled that the only person that could take action against that was the United States government. You may know this better than I. And therefore, no private individual could jump a foreigner's claim. But the United States government could throw him out if it wanted to. But it never wanted to. So these people who were not United States citizens were able to stake those claims and work them. Well, Noyes, I think he was a perfectly honest man in spite of history, but he was very weak, and he was hoodwinked into some of these things that were done there.
I guess that's mercy before the he was a strong man.
Pardon?
I say the clerk of the court that always had, he was a strong man.
A fellow named McKenzie.
Yeah.
Clerk of the court.
Yeah. Well, no, Frost was clerk of the court. McKenzie was the marshal. He was afterwards Roosevelt's right-hand man in South Dakota, someplace like that. He was a big political boss, is what he was.
He took charge there.
Yeah, that's right.
Johnny McGinn, I think, one of the lawyers, I guess, he was still
in. Yeah. Johnny McGinn was a district attorney there at the time. But I don't remember Johnny McGinn from Nome, but I remember Noyes. I knew Johnny here very well, but I didn't know him there.
He came up here from Nome.
I know he did.
When did you leave Nome, Mr. Green?
I left Nome in 24. I spent 24 years there, more or less. Fall of 24, we came to Fairbanks. Well, I'd been to Fairbanks before, but I left there to live.
When did you go into politics, Mr. Lee? I first heard of you, I believe. I came up at 35, but I was pretty young, and I heard of you first when you were highway engineer for the territory, I believe.
Well, I think I got in by a fluke. I'm not a politician.
Everybody had to get elected then, I guess.
I was elected I don't know how it ever happened. I didn't campaign.
What year was that, 36 or?
No, that was, I was elected in 52.
Oh. Time passes.
Well, time certainly does. Tempest fidgets.
Well, Mr. Reed, wasn't your father a judge in Juneau in 1928, 29 or something?
Yes, he died on the bench in Juneau in 1928.
You repeat that question, it won't be on the tape, it won't make sense.
Oh, was my father a judge in Juneau? He was a judge there from 1922 to 1928 when he died on the bench.
You'll forgive me for speaking.
No, that's right. I'm glad you do that, because I don't realize that I'm being recorded.
Some of us speak louder in records, but I know they didn't, you see.
Yeah. Is there any other...
Mr. Reed, you tell of, you tell what the difference is between an Eskimo and an Indian.
Well, a difference between, can I tell the difference between an Eskimo and an Indian? Yes, there is quite a difference, a decided difference. The Eskimo is if you're an anthropologist, he has a dolichocephalic head and a disharmonic head. He is a... probably was originally a white man, but he's been mongolized by Mongol blood, and it probably the latest thing on him, idea on it, he came from, started out somewhere in the eastern side of Russia, around the Murmansk coast or something on the White Sea, and worked westward from there. But that's just theory. The Indian, the Athabascan, is Athabascan. He is a relative of the Navajo and the Apache. He's your first cousin. He is a what the anthropologists call a brachycephalic man. He's short-headed, and he's entirely different speech, entirely different build, and no apparent relationship at all between them. Well, they may be mixed in places. I know they are. And there may be a connection between the present Central Asiatics and the Athabascans. They think they're able to find a connection in the Athabascan language and some of the Tibetans and those people in there. I'm not sure about that. I'm not an anthropologist. I just read something on
it. Mr. Reed, are you familiar with an incident in early Nome when two or three men tried to license the miners on the beach, tried to make them buy licenses to mine?
I heard about that, yeah. No, the beach was discovered probably by a soldier. That the discovery of the beach is, Nome was, had these early men, first comers in there, had staked the whole country, and people just couldn't make a living. So the discovery by a soldier in the early 1900 of the beach diggings relieved the pressure. And or they'd have been a terrific blow up there, I'm sure, because they were holding miners' meeting. I've read this. I was there, but I wasn't conscious of it being a 10-year, 11-year-old kid. But the discovery there, and they laid out the decision that no one could stake the beach, was another thing. The beach was staked, and they tried to keep miners from working on it, and they paid a royalty. But then
that's what I heard later.
Yeah, then they just
the they opened the beach up, anybody could go down there.
Anybody, and he could mine, dig as far as he could reach with his shovel. That was the rule, the miner's rule, as far as he could reach with his shovel. And some of them made quite a little money there. They made about $20 a day, which was going wages of $5 a day. And that was the highest wages in the United States, $5 a day and board, quite a difference.
Something that's always puzzled me is why did Bering strike for the Aleutians when you could see the Seward Peninsula from Siberia on a clear day? Why did he strike so far?
Well, he came from the... you'd like to read... I have Bancroft's history of Alaska.
Well, I've read it a couple of times, and I've never been able to figure out why he wound up...
Well, because he started out from the Kamchatka Peninsula, which was so far south that he didn't know anything about East Cape, and that he could see across.
I looked it up on the map, but I always...
Yeah, he started from Petropavlovsk one day, and...
That's 2,500 miles south.
Yeah. And of course, the first thing he hit was the Aleutian Islands.
And he was interested in fur, and
that's
the
right.
That the fur market was what they were working for. So he'd be striking as far north as he could if he was looking for fur.
Well, you'd think so, but I think he didn't know what he was doing. He was just sailing. That's all. I think if it had been an English navigator or a Bering was a Dane, wasn't he? I think he was kind of, you know, the difficulties of getting started and the terrible hardships he had to getting his stuff across Siberia made an old and timid man out of him by the time he got his ships in the water. And he got, I'm reading between the lines, that's what I would say, and he just ventured out of sort of a protest. He was just doing it because that was his duty, but he didn't want to do it. If it had been left in the hands of Chirikov, I think we'd have had, they'd have really made some discoveries, or if it had been an English or American captain in charge, they'd have really gone to town. But those old Russians, after they got started, they were really adventurous. They tied their boats together with rawhide thongs and started out across the sea. Wonder if they all hadn't been drowned.
Mr. Reed, we have coffee ready, and I imagine people would like to take a little stretch, and we don't want to wear you out either. So
I hope I haven't bored people.
You haven't. We've been very, very happy to have you.
That's the termination of Mr. Reed's talk at the Historical Society this evening. And this is Pioneer Igloo 4 tape recording taken at the Historical Society, July the 27th, 1961. This is Harry Hughes recording for Igloo 4.